Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Culture Heritage Fund. Helping you discover the Twin Cities, it is Radio K's Real College Podcast, online and on the air. My name is Matthew Kudis, and this week we are reading the headlines. We're shying away from the usual fun and frolic of arts and entertainment to cover things far more pressing, the things that are affecting Minnesotans across the board. New legislation may jeopardize a large part of northern tourism, and one of the most controversial stories in Minneapolis enters a new chapter. Also, we hear the word on the street with me and participation points with Jackie Renzetti and Radio K's weekly release spotlight. And it all starts right now on the Real College Podcast. Over the last 6 months, the Jamar Clark case has been one of the most controversial stories in Minneapolis to date. Producer for the show, David Lean, takes us through how the event sparked a burst of enthusiasm from activists across the city. Take all the love you're given, fill the gap in the wall.
Last November, Americans learned yet another name in the long list that includes Mike Brown, Sandra Bland, and Tamir Rice.
Jamar Clark
is yet another black person killed by police who became known to the country through a post-mortem hashtag. Like similar cases in other cities, Clark's death inspired mass organization and protests here in his Minneapolis community. However, the community response here went beyond just tight planning and raw passion, achieving true innovation in organizing in potentially unprecedented ways. We'll take a look at the Justice for Jamar protests and how they continue to affect this city. The story started in the wee hours of Sunday, November 15th, 2015, in North Minneapolis. There are two conflicting accounts of the incident. The police state that Clark resisted arrest and attempted to take the gun of one of the officers when the other shot him in the head. Dozens of eyewitnesses, on the other hand, have claimed that Clark was already subdued, even handcuffed, when the police shot him. Tatiana Buckner was in her son's room across the street when she heard the shot, and she and her neighbors were amongst the first on the scene in the immediate aftermath.
Until about 4 or 5 in the morning, it was about 5 to 8 of us just standing there. Like, not even knowing what to do, just standing there, kind of like in solidarity, observing the police, taking what pictures could be taken, filming what could be filmed.
That loose group of people was the humble beginning of what would become a massive 18-day occupation of the 4th Precinct Police Station. But the community never planned such an elaborate response. According to Misha Grimm, a co-founder of the Minneapolis chapter of Black Lives Matter, the decision to stay at the precinct until demands were met was entirely spontaneous.
When we did the march from where he was shot to the 4th precinct, there were a lot of young people that said that they didn't want to leave the precinct until they were arrested. That turned into an occupation because they were never arrested, so they didn't leave.
Within hours, the initial handful of people camped out in the precinct's front vestibule were joined by local organizations like the Black Liberation Project, Neighborhoods Organizing for Change, Black Lives Matter, and the NAACP. More calls went out through social media for support and supplies. By the second day, the occupation hadn't just grown. It had exploded.
15 tents.
That's Michael McDowell, another co-founder of Black Lives Matter Minneapolis.
And we have about, I'm going to say like 10 tables set up just so folks can actually like serve the food and drinks and stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's like stations for you to like get drinks and get warm drinks and like coffee and all that stuff. And then you like go to the other side of the precinct and you can like get all your food and mm-hmm. It's like a buffet-style setup.
The rate of expansion of the occupation only grew as days went on. The camp eventually exceeded 20 tents, with amenities like a full working kitchen, two porta-potties, a food shelf, a clothing drive, warming lamps and fire pits, a heated trailer, and even a massage tent. Volunteers were so enthusiastic that charts were created to manage shifts for cooking and cleanup. People who couldn't stay or come to the precinct made up for it by providing everything else.
And was all this stuff donated?
Yeah. All donated.
People ordered food for protesters or brought them winter clothes on a moment's notice. Someone rented the porta potties for the occupation. When it rained one day, someone showed up with enough pallets and hay to elevate the entire camp. DeRay McKesson, arguably the most visible figure in the national movement, stopped by the occupation on its third day. Though he now spends most of his time campaigning for mayor of Baltimore, at the time, McKesson traveled across the country, visiting hundreds of protests. He said he had not seen organizing this sophisticated anywhere else.
I think that the level of organization that's present tonight is incredible, and I've not seen it like this before, like a porta potty, these parcels. I mean, this is like super thoughtful. I've definitely seen protesters organize in creative ways across the country, and this is another example of really creative organizing using a host of resources, both from protesters and from people who are supporting protesters.
Yeah, he loved the porta potties so much.
Once again, Misha Grimm.
He was just like, this is the best organizing I've ever seen. He also said something like, do all these people donate this stuff? Is it a lot of white people donating stuff because they feel guilty? And I was like, absolutely.
Like, the sheer infrastructure of the occupation certainly suggested more people were donating than protesting. If it was mostly white people donating, then a strong argument was made for the efficiency of white-supported black leadership in organizing this community. And it was a community, as people formed bonds across the negative stereotypes of the North Side. People discovered that they shared a community with others not through geography, but through shared values and morals. These connections and support were facilitated by the prolific, skillful use of social media.
Social media was our number one tool at the 4th Precinct. There were so many situations that we were put in by the police that were illegal and dangerous that people found out about because of social media. There were so many instances of people just genuinely caring and wanting to make sure people are okay because of social media.
Social media lowered the barriers of access to information and solidarity between protesters and outsiders, creating a democratic and populist atmosphere at the 4th Precinct that activists encouraged.
We want to actually show the community that it's like, it is like, this is a leaderful community. Like, we all can like step up, we all can plan events like this. Like, this was as simple as throwing up a Facebook page and saying, well, we're like occupying it.
Activists deliberately use social media to center and promote the community's message, as well as empower everyday citizens to organize. However, the occupation was subject to constant tensions that threatened to obscure those messages. On the third day of the occupation, police forced occupiers out of the vestibule. Later on, they tore down half the encampment. However, rather than turning violent, protesters expressed a refusal to give police an excuse to crack down.
No violence!
And above all, a hearty resilience.
We're gonna put it right back up.
That's all right, we'll get it,
we'll
get it.
We're gonna put it right back up.
And they did, within minutes, in fact. That resilience was put to the test again and again throughout the rest of the occupation. 5 days later, on Monday, November 23rd, five people were shot outside the precinct by four domestic terrorists. The community celebrated a huge Thanksgiving dinner at the precinct 3 days later, undeterred. Finally, early in the morning of the 18th day, December 3rd, police cleared away the occupation. Clark's death and the ensuing occupation shaped the movement in Minneapolis unlike anything before. Local activists have been working on these issues long before last November, of course, but according to Grimm, the specific circumstances of Clark's death provided the perfect storm to finally galvanize mass action and organization.
The reason why we started doing what we do is because we knew that black people were getting killed everywhere, and that included Minnesota. It just was that we didn't have that particular example while people were paying attention. So when Jamar Clark happened, it finally flipped a switch for a lot of people here that, oh my God, like, perhaps there is police brutality here.
Protesters and organizers capitalized on that attention by keeping Jamar Clark and all he represented in the news, putting pressure on elected officials. Their innovations didn't stop with the 4th Precinct, either. Weeks after the occupation was cleared, activists announced that they would protest at the Mall of America during the height of Christmas shopping. A similar protest had been staged the previous Christmas, resulting in a controversial and lengthy legal battle. Organizers knew the announcement and subsequent protests would cause a major distraction, allowing them to move to what they later said was their true target all along.
Clark, turns out the threat of a major protest at the Mall of America was just a decoy. Black Lives Matter now saying they were targeting the airport all along, where protesters disrupted one of the busiest travel days.
I've been unable to find any precedent for a decoy protest. At the end of March, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman announced that he would satisfy one of the movement's demands, and in doing so, break a 40-year precedent.
The ensuing months have given me more time to think about the grand jury. As an elected official, I also took that time to meet with more people and to listen to their concerns. I concluded that the accountability and transparency's limitations of a grand jury are too high a hurdle to overcome. So at this point in time, we in Hennepin County will not use a grand jury in the Jamar Clark case.
Freeman would instead decide the case himself. On March 30th, he made his announcement.
The Hennepin County Attorney's Office has concluded that criminal charges are not warranted against either Officer Mark Ringenberg or Officer Dustin Schwartzy.
Mel Reeves, a writer and political activist who co-founded the Twin Cities Coalition for Justice for Jamar, said that organizers, though discouraged, expected Freeman to make this decision. And now that he has, that hasn't changed the movement's central goal.
Our demand from the very beginning was that we want a prosecution. We didn't care how they did it. Even if they used the grant, we demand a prosecution. That's always been our demand. It's still our demand. We're going to keep demanding that Mark Ringenberg and Dustin Schwartzy be arrested and charged in jail for killing Jamar Clark.
In the aftermath of the announcement, it can be easy to miss the fruits of the protesters' labor. Most of their initial demands have in fact been met. The FBI and Department of Justice are conducting an independent investigation into the MPD. The officers involved have been identified. A grand jury was not used to decide the case. One of the most frequent requests, release any video of the incident, has also been met. Mike Freeman posted the videos as well as all the other evidence he viewed online in what MPD Union President Bob Kroll has called the most transparent investigation he's ever seen. But despite all that, many feel that the community's core demand from day one has still not been met: justice. This does not deter the movement from pressing forward. In fact, Grimm says that's not an option.
We don't have the luxury of being able to lose this momentum because that just means more death.
Ultimately, these protests have been about a community's need to heal from trauma. They hope that justice for Jamar will begin the healing not just for this case, but for all injustices they have suffered. Activists are now planning the next phase of that healing process, focusing on the federal investigations, challenging the prosecution, and laying the groundwork for a massive change of the local political guard next year. Given protesters' track record over the last half year, if politicians in Minneapolis want to anticipate the movement here in the future, they should expect the unexpected. From Minneapolis, this is David Lean for Real College Podcast.
This week on Participation Points, we're turning our attention to the Unlimited Dance Marathon. Students first brought this program here about 6 years ago, and every spring they donate a year's worth of fundraising to the Masonic Children's Hospital here at the University of Minnesota. They cap off their efforts with a 12-hour dance marathon fundraiser, and before this year's marathon on April 16th, Matt Dutchin is here to tell us more about it. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Matt Dutchin. I'm a senior studying animal science. I'm the director of recruitment for Unlimited Dance Marathon.
Could you tell us all about what Unlimited Marathon does?
Yeah. So Unlimited Dance Marathon is a student group. It's run by all students with help from the foundation, the University of Minnesota's foundation, so some pro staff people. But we plan the big dance marathon in the spring. So it's always in the spring. It's 12 hours of no sitting, no sleeping. It's a lot of fun, a lot of free food and stuff. But it's a fundraiser for our University of Minnesota Masonic Children's Hospital. We also do different events throughout the year, so like different fundraising events, different events with the families and stuff.
How did it first come about at the U of M?
Yeah, so we were the last Big Ten school to get it. A lot of other schools have a dance marathon that could be longer or shorter, but we finally got it about 6 years ago, and we've kept it ever since.
So how did you first get involved with Unlimited Dance Marathon?
Yeah. So I first got involved my freshman year. I had a guy who was talking about it, and he wanted us to all go, so I went. I didn't know anything about it, didn't know how to really dance, so it's not a problem if you're not a dancer. But I went, I loved it. I saw a lot of cool things. I remember the ballroom club came, they danced, and the tap group came, and they got us trying these tap shoes to actually try tap dancing.
Oh, cool.
So I got hooked on it ever since.
So what made you want to keep coming back and volunteer throughout the year? Because now you've been here, now you're a senior. So, I mean, what makes you keep coming back?
There's a lot of things. There's always families at the event. So hearing their stories, talk about it, it's very touching, and it's a lot of fun to get involved with the families. But for me, it's just to find the reason to be there to help someone else just by having fun is what makes me keep coming back.
There was something I wanted to ask you. I'm curious, why have a dance marathon specifically as opposed to like a different type of fundraiser, like, you know, making cookies or something else? I feel like there's something special about having the focus be dance specifically, and I'm just wondering about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, we want to say a dance marathon because we want to move and dance for the kids who can't be. We pledge to stay on our feet for the 12 hours for the kids who are stuck in bed or can't really walk around because they're going through treatments. If the kids can fight through all the stuff that they have to go to, we can stay on our feet for at least the 12 hours and have some fun and dance while we're at it.
Do you have any favorite memories from your experience, either fundraising during the year or at the actual dance marathon?
Yeah, I've been to a lot of dance marathons. So I have a lot of memories. One of my favorite memories, I've been able to travel a lot. So I've been to Iowa's and Wisconsin's dance marathons. So I've got to meet a lot of fun people. One of the best things was going to meet a family. They did a painting event, so I went to them, did painting with them. They invited me to go to a skating event, all this fun stuff. So being close with the family, and they've reached out to me about my own personal things. So it's a very close relationship that I've built with them. Also, one of my favorite things about it is I have these one pair of shoes that I've taken to all the dance marathons. They haven't broken yet. They're definitely a little ripped up. The heel's broken out, but they just keep going just like me at all the marathons. So I think that's really fun.
So is there still time for anyone to still get involved? Like, could they still sign up?
Yep. Registration's always available. Even at the day of the event, if you decide to just walk up, you can totally, just register there. But you can register online at unlimiteddm.org. There's a register link. Click right up. It takes 5 minutes to register, if that. We're also going to be tabling at different residence halls this weekend, next week. So you can stop by, say hi to us. We have free candy and we're pretty nice, I like to think.
And is there anything else you wanted to add?
If you're not a dancer, it's not a problem. There's dancing. There's stuff you'll learn and have fun with. But there's also a bounce house, two bounce houses. So
wow.
Every student likes bounce houses. But there's also a bunch of free food and different student group performances. So if you know a friend that's in a group, feel free to come support them. Free food, free friends, and free fun. There's nothing better than that.
Sounds great. Well, thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate having you here.
Thank you for having me.
And now we'll get back to the Real College Podcast.
This is Olivia Iverson, and word on the street has it that First Avenue is hosting Aurora for a Wednesday night show this week at 7:30 p.m. As a Norwegian pop singer and songwriter who kept her talent from her parents until she was a teen, she makes music that will make you understand why her name literally translates to Fjord of the Lights.
The picture was a painting of you, and for a moment I thought you were happy, but then again it wasn't true. And all this time I have been lying, oh, lying in secret to myself. I've been putting sorrow on the forest place on my shelf. Da-dee-da. And I was running far away. Would I run off the world someday? Nobody knows, nobody knows. And I was dancing in the rain, felt alive, and I can't complain. Take me home where I live alone. I got no other place.
If you're eager to hear popular music groups right out of Minneapolis, the Four on the Floor will be taking stage at First Avenue at 8 p.m. on Friday night. This group's unique name derives from their songs that are all played in 4/4 time. Their stompin' blues will be sure to get you moving.
I'm drunk on Tuesdays. I'm drunk as you can see. Oh, I'm drunk on Tuesdays. I'll be mumbling the blues away. Just watch me now.
What do Kid Cudi and Father John Misty have in common? Father John Misty was featured on Kid Cudi's 2013 album, Indicud. And while Kid Cudi won't be at Northrop on Saturday at 7:30 p.m., Father John Misty will. After ending his solo career, Jay Tillman has released two indie rock albums under the name Father John Misty, and you'll hear songs like this one.
Am I bread and butter?
Also on Saturday night, Caroline Smith will be performing her sold-out show that is the first of her tour at First Avenue at 8 p.m. In her 2013 album, Half About a Woman, she merges her 90s R&B and neo-soul with her indie rock roots. Encompassing her transition from a girl to woman, her song Magazine fights a woman's social expectations.
This is Olivia Iverson, and this has been Word on the Street. See you next time.
I can't imagine anything less fun than being stuck on a boat in the middle of a lake fishing with Patrick Sharkey. But still, some people choose to do that, and I suppose that's what makes this country great. But if that was your plan for the summer, there's some bad news coming from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. The shark himself has more.
The city can wait. I'll never sleep again. Got plans for today.
Jeff Jaskolka, a recreational fisherman from Chaska, Minnesota, has attended nearly every fishing opener on Lake Mille Lacs since he moved to Minnesota in 1975. This year, however, there's been a change of plans. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources announced last week new restrictions for walleye fishing on the lake this year. Anglers will be forced to catch and release all walleye, and they will not be allowed to use any live bait to attract the fish. The hope is that these restrictions will help bolster the dwindling walleye population in what has long been seen as one of the best fishing lakes for walleye in the nation. But for people like Jeff, the thought of not being able to keep anything they catch has them looking elsewhere.
We like to get a meal of fish, and it's not even that so much, because a lot of times I go fishing, I keep nothing, and I do catch keepers. But this is just the idea, if you drive 2 hours to go fish, that you'd like to be able to keep something, if they're biting.
The walleye population in Mille Lacs reached historic lows last year, which resulted in the DNR closing last year's fishing season on Mille Lacs early. For a town whose economy relies so heavily on tourism from fishing, a catch-and-release-only season could have disastrous effects. Still, some locals try to remain positive. Tina Chapman, the executive director of Mille Lacs Area Tourism, says they saw some of these restrictions coming.
You know, we knew that it was going to be tight regs this year. I think the live bait restriction, that's not making a whole lot of people very happy. But the catch and release part of it, you know, that was not unexpected.
However, just because some local businesses saw this coming doesn't mean they haven't been affected.
Well, it affects right down to the kid fishing off the dock that wants to go out and throw a worm on, you know, and fish for panfish. So it kind of takes away that family aspect of it. I'm hearing cancellations around the lake. I talked to even the local marine dealer, and he winterizes and stores boat, and he said he had 3 calls already from people that said, don't bother taking my boat out of the storage because I'm not putting it in this year. It's definitely going to be a challenge to, you know, weather the storm, but we'll get through it, hopefully.
The people that own these businesses, I can't, you know, that gas station just north of Monamia closed on the corner. It's been there for years. That just closed probably the last year. Used to have bait and gas, and we'd stop there all the time. It's closed now.
I'm Mike Verdea with McCoy's Inn and Event Center. I'm a fishing guide, a launch captain, and I also help manage the resort. You know, it's not a shock to us. It'll be a shock to the general public that, you know, is going to read it, see it everywhere, and, you know, they're going to, you know, form opinions on that. But it doesn't change a lot from what we've been doing. You know, last year we go out there, if we caught 100 fish, we might keep one. You know, and everyone had a blast. But the fact that they're being told they can't keep anything instead of the, you know, kind of feeling that we can have something, it shouldn't be that important. I don't think it's that important to keep fish. We do it because it's a lot of fun to catch fish. And most people fish right now because it's a lot of fun to fish. I didn't think it was going to be that important, but, you know, we unfortunately have lost a group. You know, it's not like we're losing a lot yet, but hopefully this isn't a sign for things to come.
The DNR restrictions have caught the attention of at least one local lawmaker. State Senator Dave Brown from Becker has announced legislation to overturn the restrictions. Additionally, 2 of the 8 Native American tribes who, by treaty, have the right to roughly 30% of the walleye harvest have announced they will discontinue their use of netting to catch walleye this year in an effort to help restore the walleye population. For the Real Ecology Podcast, in Mille Lacs, I'm Patrick Sharkey.
And that concludes this week's Real College Podcast. Thank you to Patrick Sharkey, David Lean, and Jackie Renzetti for contributing to this week's show. Our producers are Max Fuller, Patrick Sharkey, Jackie Renzetti, and David Lean. And our managing editor is me, Matthew Curtis. You can find us on RadioK.org, iTunes, and on Sundays at 6 p.m. on Radio K. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Culture Heritage Fund, and thank you for listening.